Oh, okay. So Giacomo is going to do the Donahue thing and bring you a mic. Who has a question? So many people have questions. Way in the back with you have a hat on. Yeah. Giacomo, you got to run.
I just had two small questions. The first is, how do you see like neighbors of Israel and Palestine playing an effective role, specifically Jordan and Egypt? And the second question is, do you think that the oil-rich countries, like the Gulf countries, can actually like play any role in this, or you think that they are just pro-American on the same line with America?
Egypt in particular, I don't have to tell you, is kind of in flux. So a lot depends on what goes on in Egypt. But traditionally, actually, since in 1971, it's worth knowing the history. In 1971, Egypt under Sadat offered Israel a full peace treaty, nothing for the Palestinians. That was before the Palestinian issue became an international issue, in return for withdrawal from the Sinai, okay, Egyptian Sinai. Well, Israel considered it and rejected it. They said they wouldn't withdraw. Everything depended on, as always, on what the United States would do. There was an internal bureaucratic struggle in the United States. Henry Kissinger insisted that on what he called stalemate, no negotiations, just force. So he backed Israel's refusal. That led to the 1973 war. It goes on and on like that. But Egypt all along has been in favor of a political settlement. Jordan, even more so. They know that they have no hope other than a political settlement. So I think they're kind of nothing for them to do. Egypt's the most important country. The oil dictatorships, that's a very interesting question. The question is whether they can continue to resist any of the democratization efforts in the Arab Spring. Of course, the U.S., naturally, and its allies are strongly opposed to democracy in the Arab world. Very good reasons for that. Not the rhetoric, but you can easily understand why, for obvious reasons. And they've been backing the major countries they care about are the oil dictatorships. That's where the wealth is. And so far, they've been quite successful in repressing almost anything. There were a couple of efforts in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait to join the protests, but the security presence was so huge that people were afraid to go out in the streets. In eastern Saudi Arabia, which is a very crucial area, for two reasons. One, that's where most of the oil is, and two, it's mostly Shiite, not Sunni. There were significant uprisings, and they were just crushed pretty violently. No criticism from the West. That's what they're supposed to be doing. Same pretty much throughout. Now, if that can be maintained, if the U.S. can help the oil dictatorships suppress any, maybe some mild move towards reform, like, a legislative council or something, then they'll do what the U.S. says. I mean, they have no particular love for the Palestinians. In fact, they don't like them. They don't want them. They regard them just as a nuisance. So they're not much of an agency, I don't think. They want to hold on to their wealth, client status, and so on. But a lot depends. There's a lot of ferment in that region, and it's unpredictable. I mean, what's happened the last year or two is very important. Actually, take a look at. If you want to think about how important it is, just take a look at another part of the world. It's very useful to look. The United States, remember, is a global power. We may focus, one meeting focuses on the Middle East, another one focuses on Latin America, and so on and so forth. But U.S. planners focus on the world, and we should too. So take a look at another part of the world, Latin America. As far back as you want to go, Latin America was just in the pocket of the United States. They were the client regimes. They did what you said. If they didn't do it, we sent, overthrew the governments and installed dictatorships, just, over and over again, not a second thought. The last 10 years, Latin America pulled out totally. Latin America's the most independent part of the world now. There was a dramatic illustration of it just about a week or two ago, of course. The facts were there. It didn't get commented on, but you think about it. The Open Society Forum, Soros's Open Society Forum, published a study of countries that participated in rendition. Rendition is the U.S. global torture program. There were 54 countries that participated, practically all of Europe, Middle East, of course, because that's where they sent them to be tortured, Africa, Asia. One part of the world, not a single country was willing to participate. South America, Latin America. And that's startling for two reasons. One, that was always the most subordinated, obedient part of the world. And two, it was the torture center of the world. As long as the U.S. was running it, it was the torture center of the world for the last half century. But now in 10 years, totally out of it. You know, they don't have anything to do with it. There's kind of an interesting article in Foreign Affairs, next issue, you might take a look, you know, the main establishment journal, one of the main apologists for U.S. power, Michael Shifter, has an article about Chavez, and it's quite interesting. What he says is, in the 1990s, everything in Latin America looked really positive. Everyone was coming together to form the democratic market societies under the U.S. aegis, following the U.S. vision and so on. And then all of a sudden, this evil demon showed up, Chavez, and he broke the whole story up. Now everybody's against us. I mean, you know, it's the kind of fantasy that a kind of ultra-imperialist fanatic might dream up. But what happened is an uprising against U.S. hegemony, against neoliberalism and the rest of it. But so you got to blame it on some magical character, you know, who somehow achieved all of this. That's what it's like on the inside of the intellectual establishment. Places like this, for example. This is the heart of it. That's the kind of thing that's believed. You read in the articles and the journals and so on. And you have to look carefully to think what's happening. It's not that deep. It's not profound. But and the same thing could happen in the Middle East and North Africa, so-called MENA countries. And the West is very upset about it. That's why they've tried very hard to prevent any movement towards democracy there, particularly in the dictatorships. But it's not under control. You know, it could get out of control. Now you pick.
I am. I'm surveying the scene. So I'm trying to figure out how to describe you. I'm looking right at you. You have long hair and your hand, you look behind, yeah, you. Yes, you have your hand up. You have a long sleeve gray V-neck sweater on. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Stand up so Giacomo can find you.
So you argue at least that the U.S. in part stepped in against apartheid for financial reasons, which clearly won't be present in Israel-Palestine. And I'm just wondering, are like human rights violations ever going to be offensive enough or strong enough to convince the U.S. government to step in? Or are we waiting for something more?
Well, the United States cares nothing about human rights violations. Care a lot about human rights violations in Iran, let's say, or in the Soviet Union or something, but not in our domains. It's very dramatically obvious. I mean, just compare, say, our domains, say, Latin America, with Eastern Europe throughout the whole Cold War period, you know, after Stalin's death, you know, since long, from, say, Kennedy on. I mean, human rights violations in Latin America were incomparably worse than in Eastern Europe, incomparably worse. But what did you hear about? Well, you heard about Václav Havel being imprisoned in Czechoslovakia, which is bad, he shouldn't have been. did you hear about six Latin American intellectuals, Jesuit priests at the same time, having their brains blown out by US-run terrorist forces that had just been gotten their renewed training in the John F. Kennedy counterinsurgency school? No, you didn't hear about that. Because that's okay, you know. I mean, you take a look at scholarship, they don't suppress it. I mean, human rights violations in Latin America were far worse. But the only thing we ever talked about is Eastern Europe, where it was bad, but you know, nothing like what we were doing during the same years. And right now it's the same thing. I mean, take, say, Iran. I mean, Iran's a very repressive state. But if you take, say, for example, the status of women, well, they're far better off in Iran than they are in the oil dictatorships, our allies. You know, it's just incomparable. You take a look at, say, intellectual culture. It's a very interesting study by Pervez Hoodbhoy, who'll be here in a couple of days. He's a Pakistani physicist, wonderful guy, very brave human rights activist. He's been fighting about this for years, very dangerous. He's a physicist, and he's pointed out that in Pakistan, under U.S. domination, mainly under Reagan, along with Saudi Arabia, the country was radically Islamized. And he said one effect is that science has disappeared. He says, because you got to memorize the Quran. And he says, and what he points out is that the whole Muslim world, the part of the Muslim world where there's religious influence, not Egypt, there's only one country which has maintained a very high intellectual level, Iran. You know, do you read that in the papers? No. I mean, Iraq was the most advanced country in the Arab world. Practically, Iraq, I mean, had...
Not anymore.
Had first world standards. Now it's a total wreck. The educational system's been ruined. The intellectual class has been destroyed. It's gone, you know, the sanctions and the war. In fact, Hoodbhoy makes another interesting point. He says he visited, he doesn't like Iran, he hates the regime, but he said he visited Iran recently and he took a taxi cab with a woman driver. And he said he's never seen a woman taxi cab driver in New York. Certainly not in Saudi Arabia. You know, but that's not what we read about. We care about human rights violations in enemy states for propaganda purposes, but the human rights violations are of no interest.
There we are.
Okay, you suggest that when the president of the U.S. Tells Israel what to do, Israel will do it. But does that imply that it is just the president who has the power to influence Israel's decision? How about Congress and the effect of the Israeli lobby on them? How do they come into play? What will change the situation?
I didn't understand.
Okay, so the question is, what about the Israel lobby?
Israel lobby?
Is it honestly, simply the U.S. president that influences Israel? What about Congress? What about AIPAC? What about the Zionist lobby?
Well, I mean, there's a big lobby, undoubtedly. Part of it is what's called the Israel lobby, AIPAC, let's say. Actually, there's a much bigger lobby. It's the Christian right lobby, Christian religious lobby. Take a look at the Hegel hearings, okay? They're very interesting. In the Hegel hearings, the Republicans were going after him, you know, hammer and tongs, mostly on Israel. He wasn't strong enough on Israel. Who votes for Republicans? And who gives money to Republicans? Jewish money and Jewish votes go to the Democrats, overwhelmingly. But the Republicans have a base, Christian evangelical base. And that's happened in the last 20 years. As the Republican Party kind of drifted off the spectrum, they stopped being a political party. They're just, you know, lockstep subservience to wealth and corporate power. They had to do something to get votes. And to get votes, they had to mobilize parts of the population, which have always been there, but weren't politically mobilized. This is a very religious country, probably more so than Iran. You know, I've never seen a poll, but I doubt that in Iran half the population thinks the world was created a couple thousand years ago. That's not a joke. And they weren't politically mobilized before, but now they are, and the Republicans need them. That's their voting base. Also, nativists, you know, guys racing around, like, have to collect guns because the federal government's coming after us. And these things have always been there, but now that's the Republican base. And you saw that in the Hagel hearings. Those people are passionately pro-Israel and fanatically anti-Semitic. It combines. You take a look at the theology. It's worth looking at. The theology is we got to have a war between the Jews and the Arabs, and they all slaughter each other at Armageddon, and the saved souls rise to heaven. Everyone else goes to eternal damnation, except for 144,000 Jews who converted in time, found Christ in time, and Jesus comes down, you know, 1,000 years of peace, on and on. You know, an awful lot of the country believes this. Actually, people like George Bush probably believed it. And that's not a joke. There's evidence for it. But it's a very powerful, in fact, Christian Zionism altogether goes back way before Jewish Zionism as an elite phenomenon. Lord Balfour, you know, Woodrow Wilson, Harold Ickes in the Roosevelt administration. I mean, all of these guys were Christian Zionists. You read the Bible says, you know, God told Abraham, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the chosen people have to go back to Palestine. The others don't belong there. They're Canaanites or something. And that's a big strain in first British and then American policy. And it's had its effects, like the Balfour Declaration, say. And many other things, and it's now showing up. It's being combined now with an ultra-right Christian evangelical base, which is huge, and it very dramatically showed up in the Hagel hearings. I mean, most of the senators don't give a damn one way or another. They're placating their base, but that's the way you do it. And it wasn't AIPAC. AIPAC kept quite quiet. So yeah, AIPAC's real. It's a significant lobby. There are other lobbies. Actually, the biggest pro-Israel lobby is probably military and intelligence military industry. They're very close connections with Israel, very close. If you looked at the WikiLeaks, one of the interesting WikiLeaks exposures didn't get much publicity, unfortunately, was a list of strategically parts of the world that were so strategically significant that we just had to maintain them, defend them. One of them was Rafael Military Industries, right outside Haifa, which is an advanced military production installation. It's one of the places they develop drones, very tightly connected with U.S. military industry. In fact, so tightly connected that a couple of years ago, Rafael shifted their management offices to Washington so they'd be closer to the money. That's a big... They're powerful. I mean, they're way more powerful than AIPAC. You know, they really have power. The American corporate sector, if it wants, I mean, one of the weaknesses in this Israeli lobby argument, which I mean, it's real. You know, I don't doubt that they're significant, but think through the consequences. I mean, suppose the Israeli lobby was really, like, say, Mearsheimer and Waltz. Suppose that it was harming U.S. interests. Okay, I don't know, what are U.S. interests supposed to be? Well, U.S. interests, operative U.S. interests are corporate interests. And a lot of, you know, nonsense in the field, but that's in reality what they are. So suppose they're harming corporate interests. Well, there's a tactical consequence. There's a tactical advice follows from that, which strikingly nobody follows. The tactical advice is we should stop doing things like this. We should stop working on boycotts and sanctions and educational programs. People like me should put on our ties and jackets, go to the headquarters of General Electric and Lockheed Martin and so on, and just explain to them politely that a lobby that you can put out of business in 5 minutes is harming your interests. And once they understand that, they'll see it and everything will be fine. Nobody suggests that. And there's a good reason for it. It's total nonsense, of course. But that's what follows from the assumption that this lobby is so powerful that they're harming the interests of really powerful sections of the corporate system that can put them out of business in no time. You know, So yes, it's a powerful ethnic lobby, no doubt about it. And it kind of gets its way on things that don't matter that much to power interests.
Interesting. I really hate to say this. I think we have time for one more. Is that fair? Yeah? It's such a horrible decision to... Gosh. How about you right here in the front? We have glasses on. Yes, you.
As a disenfranchised population, Palestinians have had to resort to guerrilla warfare, right? I mean, especially organizations such as Hamas and Hezbollah partake in terrorist activities. In your opinion, I mean, what role has this played in terms of, both the political and the, world reaction towards recognizing Palestine as a nation state?
First of all, it's not world opinion. It's U.S. and European opinion. The U.S. and Europe are very isolated from the world on issue after issue. I mean, take, say, Iran. The Iranian threat is a U.S.-European obsession. Almost nobody else in the world sees it. Not the non-aligned movement, not the Arab countries, not China, It's a U.S., British, French obsession, the old imperial powers. And the same is true on issue after issue. On Libya, for example, the three imperial powers, there they were international opinion on this. The rest of the world is against it. But on this issue, sure, that's a big propaganda issue. It's, the U.S. has no objection to terror. Uh-huh. The U.S. is one of the leading terror states in the world. It's run massive terrorist operations against Cuba, against Nicaragua. It supports terror all over the world. But of course, there's some kinds of terror we don't like, the kinds directed against ourselves or friends. That's what's called terror. And in a highly indoctrinated society like ours, that does become terror. Uh-huh. One of the reasons why our intellectual classes and our educated people are just off the world spectrum. We've all been indoctrinated with beliefs that almost nobody in the world agrees with, except for us. But since we're powerful, that's what prevails. So sure, let's take Hezbollah terror. What is it exactly? The worst Hezbollah terror is that they drove Israel out of Lebanon. I mean, Israel invaded Lebanon. It was occupying southern Lebanon in violation of Security Council orders for 22 years. During that period, it carried out 5 invasions of Lebanon, very destructive, murderous invasions with U.S. backing, and they finally were driven out by guerrilla activity, Hezbollah terror. The world doesn't look at it like that. We look at it like that, because you're not allowed to drive a client state out of illegal occupation. There are actions you can call terror, but they're pretty small, and they're not the ones the U.S. cares about. The ones the U.S. cares about is that. Same with Hamas. I mean, take, say, the rockets, the Qassam rockets. First of all, bear in mind that Israel knows precisely how to stop them, precisely, nonviolently. All you have to do is accept the ceasefire offers that Hamas has repeatedly made. And we know that during the brief period when Israel observed an agreement, a ceasefire agreement, there were no rockets. Okay, I'll give you the details if you like. From July 2008 until November 2008, there was a ceasefire, no Hamas rockets. Israel never observed the ceasefire. They maintained the siege. In November, Israel invaded Gaza, killed a bunch of Hamas activists, and then there were rockets. And in December, a couple months later, Hamas offered to renew the ceasefire, which would have ended the rockets. Israel considered the offer, rejected it, and launched Operation Cast Lead. Okay, that's the story. I mean, if you smash people over the head enough, they'll probably react. And sometimes they'll react violently, and that's terror. But it's an ideological term. It's not a descriptive term. You've got to be really careful with it. It's kind of like the African National Congress. Why was Mandela's African National Congress, one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. And it's true they carried out terrorist acts against apartheid, but is that the criterion? Yeah. In fact, it's not just them. I mean, take, say, Saddam Hussein. In 1982, the Reagan administration took Saddam Hussein off the terrorist list. Why? Because they wanted to provide him with aid in his invasion of Iraq, of Iran, okay, which they did. They supported Iraq right through. There's an empty place on the terrorist list, so they had to fill it. Who'd they fill it with? Cuba, which in fact was the target of more terrorism than probably the rest of the world combined. But okay, that's the terrorist list. Now, the terrorist list has absolutely no validity. It's as examples like this illustrate. These are propaganda instruments. And the whole field of terrorism studies, it's quite interesting. I mean, terrorism studies took off, you know, became a huge field with departments and academic studies and, you know, the international meetings, volumes, and so on in 1981. And the reason is because Reagan came into office and declared that the war on international terrorism will be the focus of U.S. foreign policy. And so all of a sudden, everybody's got to study terrorism. The terrorism had a very striking, simple meaning. It meant something they do to us, okay? At that point, the U.S. was far and away the major terrorist country in the world, wasn't even close. I also started writing on it then. A couple of other people, Ed Herman, a few other friends. But what we wrote about it doesn't enter the canon. And there's a very simple reason. We took the definition of terror from the U.S. Code and from British law, okay? And if you take those definitions, it follows that the U.S. is the leading terror state in the world. So therefore, that can't be the right definition. And ever since then, there's been a massive effort, you know, intellectual effort, the Congresses and so on, to try to craft a definition of terror. And you're constantly reading. It's really hard to get a good definition of terror, which is true. It's hard to get a definition of terror which includes just what they do to us, but doesn't include what we do to them. That's tricky. So therefore, it never really gets there. But the whole field is it's a joke. Hezbollah and Hamas are, you know, not, maybe not nice organizations. But there's another interesting thing about Hamas and Hezbollah. They happen to, every time there's a free election, they win. In the one free election, really anywhere in the Arab world, in January 2006, in Palestine, Hamas won. Lebanon has semi-free elections, you know, it's kind of distorted in many ways. But the last presidential election, the Hamas-led coalition won. They didn't get most of the parliamentary seats, but that's because of the way the French confessional system worked. The system that the French imposed on Lebanon, you know, back in the 40s, that it gave much lower votes to the Shiite population, so they don't get adequate representation. So therefore, though the Hezbollah-led coalition actually won by a considerable margin, they had a minority of the votes, which led to some interesting consequences. Thomas Friedman wrote one of, he's one of my favorite writers, I should say. There's a few people more ridiculous. He had a column after that, right after that, in which he said, you know, after the Lebanese election, he said, he's just passionate about free elections. Tears come down his eyes when there are free elections and so on. And he said he was just, you know, the Lebanese election was so magnificent because Obama defeated Iran, you know. Okay, how? A minority of the votes succeeded in putting the party in that the U.S. wanted. So therefore, free elections are just magnificent. You know, it's you really have to be, you have to look carefully at these things.
I think that does it. Thank you so much.
This concludes Professor Noam Chomsky and Dr. Hike Schutten's presentation on What Lies Ahead for Palestine. The event was organized by the Harvard College Palestine Solidarity Committee and recorded by your radio announcer, Chuck Rosina, for the Boston Community Reporters Project.